Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. On Tuesday, Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley voted against development of the Keystone XL pipeline. Merkley is opposed to further development of fossil fuels, which he said would exacerbate global warming.
This is an urgent concern that every leader should be paying attention to, because the decisions made in this generation are going to have a profound effect on whether we tackle it successfully or not.
Merkley spoke with reporters yesterday during a telephone news conference. We'll hear his comments coming up just after this break. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley was among the 41 senators who voted Tuesday against approval of the Keystone XL pipeline, which would carry Canadian tar sands oil to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. The vote was one short of the 60 required to proceed with the legislation, which passed the House earlier this week. Merkley has been a vocal opponent of the project. He spoke with reporters in a telephone press conference yesterday about his vote and his stance on carbon emissions and climate change.
Pipeline represents infrastructure designed to increase the speed with which the tar sands are exploited and converted into oil into the international market, shipping Canadian oil to the Gulf Coast and shipping it overseas. The vote was a defeat for the pipeline, perhaps a temporary defeat, because it was a 59 vote standard on the bill, or a 60-vote requirement, and it only obtained 59 votes. But I thought I'd tell you why I find this pipeline so disturbing. The most important aspect of it is that if we are going to, as an international community, tackle carbon pollution and the resulting global warming, we have to make very concerted decisions to not develop infrastructure that accelerates the exploitation of fossil fuels. The rough estimate is that to keep to a 2 centigrade increase in temperature, which is still a substantial amount, we would have to leave 4/5 of the currently identified fossil fuel reserves around the world in the ground. And so, therefore, developing new infrastructure that pulls those reserves out of the ground more quickly is a real problem. And particularly in this case, because this is the dirtiest fossil fuel on the planet, it takes a lot of energy to convert it into oil, produces a lot of waste, so it's more carbon intensive than just about any other form of oil. And this issue of global warming, it's so important to recognize that this is not some theoretical issue about what might happen 50 years from now. We're seeing it on the ground in Oregon at this very moment. We see it on the coast, where the ocean is 30% more acidic than it was, before the Industrial Revolution. And that acidity is driving great difficulty growing baby oysters, called oyster seed. I went over and visited the Whiskey Creek hatchery about 3 weeks ago. They started having troubles in 2008, and they've gone through a lot of effort to be able to get the advice on how to address this and continue producing oyster seed for the oyster industry on the coast. And this isn't just Oregon. California's having the problem. Washington State's having the problem. We have a scientist at Oregon State who studies coral reefs around the world, and he has remarked on how the combination of warmer waters and acidity are damaging the coral reefs around the world. As he said to me, he said, "These are my babies," referring to roughly 30 reefs around the world that he studied, and my babies are dying. And those reefs are the foundation for a lot of the fishing fisheries in the world that folks depend on. We see it in Oregon in terms of the longer forest fire season. It's the season across the United States has grown an average of 60 to 80 days over just the time period since the 1980s. And what that means is a lot more forests are burning. The average acres consumed annually has doubled over that time period to more than 7 million acres. There was one estimate that the global warming in terms of the greater pine beetle activity and the greater fire damage, the western forests are going to be largely decimated by the end of this century. And we also are seeing it in terms of the snowpack in the Cascades. I put up a chart on the floor yesterday when I was speaking to the bill showing the decreasing snowpack, and it's substantial. It contributes both to warmer, shallower trout streams, and for those of you who fish, you know that that's a problem, but also contributes to a decreased irrigation water. That's been one of the factors in the ongoing drought conditions that we've had in the Klamath Basin. So in short, we're seeing the impact of global warming today in Oregon on our forests, on our fishing, on our farming, and that's true for virtually any state across the country. If you're in Maine, people are talking about the lobsters going to Canada and fish from North Carolina arriving off Maine. And if you're in Florida, you're talking about how at high tide, where high tide used to be invisible, now there's water above the sidewalk level in a number of towns, and seawater starting to infiltrate the freshwater reserves that a lot of towns depend on. So it's different effects in different places, but it's very real. It's right now. This is a world challenge because we share the skies with everyone on the planet, so we have to take it on collectively. And this is why I voted against the bill yesterday. Now, those who are proponents of the bill, they argued that this is a jobs bill. The number of jobs are substantial, about 3,000 to 4,000 construction jobs. But here's the thing. We've had much bigger job bills before the Senate that my Republican colleagues have blocked. We can create a lot more jobs through transportation infrastructure, a lot more jobs through energy-saving retrofits to buildings, a lot more jobs through the Rebuild America Act, which would create hundreds of thousands of jobs. So let's have real infrastructure jobs, not use jobs as a reason to build a pipeline that will do damage to the planet. It's also been argued that this pipeline will increase our national security. That's just not the case. This is Canadian oil being shipped to the Gulf Coast to be refined, to be shipped to the world. It crosses America, but it doesn't enhance America's national security. So I think I'm just going to mention two other things that were troubling to me about this proposal. One is that the TransCanada is being exempted from the requirement to contribute to the oil spill liability fund. It makes no sense that American companies and American oil have to contribute to this fund, and TransCanada, with their very dirty oil, don't. And spills do occur in pipelines regularly. It is unacceptable that TransCanada is exempted. I am also disturbed that a foreign corporation is being given the power to take land away from Americans based on eminent domain, in which they're supposed to be a public good. But there is no public good in oil spills. There is no public good in oil simply being passed through the United States to be exported to the world, in terms of national security. And this is being challenged in the courts. And this bill would have squashed those court challenges. I think that's unacceptable, that citizens have a right to pursue adjudication of the potential misuse of eminent domain.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley in a telephone news conference with reporters yesterday. Soon, Astoria will join the ranks of communities offering those in need a secure and warm overnight shelter when temperatures drop below freezing. Astoria City Council member Drew Herzig is spearheading the project. He asked for conditional approval from the rest of the City Council this week to move forward with the project.
Our basic premise is that no one should die of exposure in Astoria. And working on that, the Astoria Senior Center is waiting for its remodel, but it's sitting empty until March. I approached the Astoria Senior Center board. They gave permission. They contacted their insurance company. Their insurance will cover it. County, Clatsop County got involved. Scott Summers, the county manager, came to some meetings. Tiffany Brown, the Clatsop County emergency manager, has been instrumental. She created a 17-page standard operating procedure manual for us. Grace Episcopal is our fiscal sponsor. Donations can are tax deductible and can be made through Grace. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So many people, so many agencies, the county, the churches, local groups are coming together to support this.
City Manager Brett Estes apprised the council of efforts made so far and asked for clarification of approval for staff to proceed.
As Councilor Herzig stated, city staff has been working with the group of folks who've been involved, the volunteers, and also with Tiffany Brown from Clatsop County. At this point, we don't have an official proposal in terms of how it will exactly be staffed. We see a lot of progress that's been made, and we see things are being addressed. And I will say that there are still maybe some questions from the police chief's perspective. There are also some questions that will need to get squared away with insurance for the city of Astoria. Mr. Schneider has been working through that, and but those are items that just need to be dealt with. I guess if tonight the city council wanted to consider whether or not this was something to be supported, that would give some direction at least to staff to know that we're moving forward in a good faith effort to achieve this.
The Astoria Senior Center at 1111 Exchange Street is the proposed warming center location. Opening hours would be from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. The center would be staffed entirely by volunteers. Herzig told the council over $800 have been raised so far, plus donations including blankets, mattress pads, and coffee. Herzing said he would personally cover utility costs if not covered by donations, and that other donations so far will likely exceed needs for the current year. The council voted unanimously to approve moving forward with preparations. City Manager Brett Estes will give the green light for opening the warming center after all city code requirements have been met. Organizers hope the center can be opened by Thanksgiving. Volunteers will be required to complete several elements of training. If you're interested in becoming a warming center volunteer, a fire extinguisher training session will be offered tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. at the Astoria Fire Department, 555 30th Street. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, former politicians and political insiders often move on to become lobbyists. In most states, there is a waiting period before former office holders can become outside influencers, but not in Washington. One state representative wants to change that, but others don't see a problem.
The people that are asked to go lobby are asked to do so because they're credible, they know the process, they know the topic, and they're good communicators.
Correspondent Austin Jenkins reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, cloudy. Showers this morning, scattered showers this afternoon, high temperatures in the low 50s. Then tonight, mostly cloudy, a 20% chance of precipitation, with isolated showers this evening, overnight lows tonight in the mid-40s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says a stronger front increases the rain chance late today, with periods of heavy rain and gusty winds possible tomorrow and tomorrow night. The snow levels fall to about 4,000 feet behind this system. The only affected passes will be in the Cascades. Saturday and Sunday, additional areas of disturbed weather move across the region, bringing periods of rain over the weekend and into the first half of next week. High temperatures stay in the low to mid-50s for the next week, and the lows remain in the mid-40s. You've heard of this revolving door. Politicians or government insiders leave public service and become lobbyists. In Washington, D.C., there's a waiting period before members of Congress and their staffers can lobby, and 32 states require some sort of cooling-off period, but not Washington State. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
In Washington, there are 960 registered lobbyists and lobbying firms. Dig into the names, and among them you'll find several former government insiders, lawmakers, chiefs of staff, agency directors, and other key staffers. Most I reached out to declined to speak for this story, but not Bill Stauffacher.
Started my firm 20 years ago this month.
Stauffacher left his job with Washington House Democrats in 1994 after Republicans swept to control.
It was a bad time to be labeled as a Democrat trying to represent business in a Republican-dominated legislature.
But Stauffacher persevered. Today, he's got a roster of mostly business clients, and he owns a home across the street from the Capitol, the ultimate status symbol of a successful lobbyist. Being self-employed has also bought him something else that he says you can't put a price on.
Coaching baseball and being around my kids, being able to see my children grow up, and having control of my calendar to be a good parent and enjoy my family life.
Stauffacher says he doesn't see a problem with government insiders becoming outside influencers as long as it's disclosed. In Washington, lobbyists have to register with the state's Public Disclosure Commission and report their clients, earnings, campaign contributions, and how much they spend entertaining. Jay Manning is another former insider.
And that is a picture of Governor Gregoire.
He's showing me pictures on the wall in his office.
And that's Michelle Obama. We got to meet her. And
Manning was chief of staff to Democratic Governor Chris Gregoire. Before that, he was director of the Washington Department of Ecology. Now he's back at his old law firm, working mostly on climate and energy issues. This work sometimes brings him into direct contact with his former agency and the legislature. Manning believes experience in and out of government is a good thing, and he bristles at the term revolving door.
That makes it sound like there's something inappropriate about a state employee leaving their job.
Manning says if anything, his former government colleagues now hold him at arm's length.
They are worried about this exact issue. So when I show up, if anything, my experience has been the vigilance around this issue actually hurts my ability to be effective.
Unlike Oregon and many other states, Washington does not require a waiting or cooling off period to slow the revolving door. You can leave state service on a Friday and start lobbying on a Monday. The New York Times recently reported on former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna. Internal documents show that less than a year after he left office, McKenna was lobbying the new AG. This all troubles Democratic State Representative Reuven Carlisle. He recently announced his intention to introduce legislation in January to require a cooling-off period. Natalie O'Donnell Wood is a state ethics expert with the National Conference of State Legislatures in Denver. She says proponents of cooling-off periods
believe that there needs to be a period of time to break the connection between working or voting on policy issues and then lobbying on the issues.
But opponents say
the people that are asked to go lobby are asked to do so because they're credible, they know the process, they know the topic, and they're good communicators.
One state lawmaker who recently made the transition to outside advocate is Bill Hinkle. He was a longtime Republican member of the Washington House. In 2012, he got hired as the executive director of the Rental Housing Association of Puget Sound. It's a job that requires some lobbying. But Hinkle still had several months left in his term. He recalls it was an awkward transition.
It was like stepping out into an area that I knew I wanted to be very clear about what the rules were.
Ultimately, Hinkle resigned his seat as a lawmaker, but he doesn't see the need for a required cooling-off period.
I think the relationships I had down there were really strong, and if I had to sit out a year, it wouldn't have mattered. Those relationships would not have dissipated.
Staffer turned lobbyist Bill Stauffacher is also wary of cooling off periods. He believes it's just an invitation to move the revolving door underground.
Then you create a whole segment of ex-government employees who advise but don't actually lobby. Now you have a gray area.
Washington does currently have an employment after public service law that restricts some activities. But ethics complaints against people who've left state service are rare, just 27 over the last two decades, and only 7 of those resulted in an actual finding of a violation. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Commercial drones are taking to Northwest skies, even though the rules aren't clear. Farmers, photographers, inspectors, real estate agents, and land mapping companies are some of the people buying remotely piloted airplanes and choppers. Now the FAA has gotten the first reports of close calls between manned aircraft and small drones in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
Rod Thomas operates an aerial spraying and seeding company out of the Gooding Airport in South Central Idaho. One day this summer, one of his crop duster pilots was spraying potato fields in Blaine County. That's when the crop duster had Idaho's first reported near miss with a small drone.
Some gentleman was either trying to chase us or block our path. We haven't figured out exactly what he was doing.
The crop duster pilot pulled up to avoid a collision, but not before he got so close he could identify the make and model of the drone.
My pilot that was involved in this encounter has one of these quadcopters for his kids. He was close enough to see it was identical to one like he owns.
Thomas says the average person may think there's no problem flying remote-controlled airplanes and copters close to the ground in a rural area. But Thomas is quick to point out his company uses that low-level airspace, too.
The regulatory agencies have not yet caught up to where they need to be. And we're worried that, number one, it hasn't been thought all the way through. And number two, we do not want this settled in the courts because there's a fatality running into an ag airplane or a life flight helicopter.
Thomas says his company reported its near miss to the county sheriff and the Federal Aviation Administration. A sheriff's deputy located the person responsible. Thomas declined to press charges after the drone owner showed contrition to the deputy. I got to wondering how often the FAA has cracked down on drone scofflaws. So I put in a public records request to the FAA's Northwest Regional Office. I asked for warning letters or related enforcement activity against people suspected of flying drones for commercial purposes. A few weeks later came a reply, "We have no records for you." The agency makes a distinction between recreational and commercial flying. It's okay for hobbyists to fly model aircraft within line of sight and away from manned planes. But a notice from headquarters to agency field offices this summer repeats that commercial drones are prohibited. Exceptions are few and far between. But we know as drone prices fall and capabilities increase, more and more people are flying drones for money in the Northwest. Just Google aerial photography in your state, for starters. You'll find operators who are upfront and transparent about how they'll capture the perfect shot using a drone. The FAA policy notice says the agency's preference is to use outreach and education to encourage voluntary compliance. What's more, a drone operator in Virginia earlier this year successfully challenged the FAA's authority to fine him. The FAA just won on appeal, but the case drags on. This all gives some farmers, photographers, and others here in the Northwest confidence they're within their rights to fly using common sense safeguards. Dennis Healy founded a startup in Redmond, Washington called FarmCloud. It helps farmers analyze and use aerial images of their fields and vineyards.
Supreme Court decisions have said the air rights over one's property and not into the national airspace are the domain of that property owner.
Is that where you come down to?
I think that's exactly where we come down, that under 500 feet, that you can pretty much fly what you want to do.
Industry analysts frequently put the ag industry at the top of the list of biggest potential users of civilian drones. It's a market entrepreneur Paul Applewhite of Seattle would like to serve, along with surveying and wildfire reconnaissance. He's designed several lightweight fixed-wing drones for his startup called Applewhite Aero. But Applewhite fears the great deal of ambiguity about domestic drone flying could stunt a promising industry.
What's difficult is the uncertainty in that you could have the federal government show up, and for every time that you flew a UAV, they could slap you with a $10,000 fine. In our case, we're actually trying to do everything as legal as possible, you know, and we're struggling to get a styrofoam airplane in the air, and it took us 2 years to do it, to get all the permits.
Next month, Applewhite plans to go to British Columbia to test a larger aircraft that he hopes will become his flagship product. He says Canada has proved much more accommodating. The U.S. Congress has directed the FAA to formulate rules for how manned and unmanned aircraft can share the domestic skies by next year, but at an industry conference in Oregon this fall, many speakers were sure the deadline will slip. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
And that is all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the home page. We welcome your comments. Call us 503-325-0010 or email to news1. That's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today. Listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.